Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write also happens to be what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from Penda Publications since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA and all they have to offer, including their yearly writers' conference, which just wrapped up a couple weeks ago here in Seattle, and it was fabulous, I must say, as someone who attended it. If you'd like to learn more about the PNWA, go to pnwa.org. I should say, we just got up our new issue of Author Magazine. It's just live now. We got three great video interviews, and two more audio. For the videos, we've got Tom Rob Smith, a suspense writer, best known for his Child 44 series, got a new thriller out now, and also Candace Robb, a.k.a. Emma Campion, the historical novelist. She talks about getting writing advice from Ursula K. Le Guin, of all people. Pretty interesting. Finally, Catherine Ma, the novelist, her first debut novel, the year she left us. She talks about going from being a reader to a writer and having to make that transition. But Tom Rob Smith's interesting. He talks about life and art overlapping. His life and his art overlap, something most suspense writers never expect to have happen. He certainly didn't, but his did, and for a short time in his life, his life became a suspense novel, and that turned into The Farm, his most recent. But I mention that not just because it's an interesting story, and you can get the whole story if you go watch the interview on authormagazine.org, but because today's guest, the wonderful writer Bruce Holbert, knows a bit about life and art overlapping. He's just released his second novel, The Hour of Lead, just a great book, and Bruce writes about the West, about what I think of as the true West, but his life and his art in many ways have spent a lot of time overlapping. Well, I'm going to let him tell the story if he wants to, but there's the myth of the West, and then there's the reality of the West, and Bruce seems to me talks about the reality of it, and I hope he'll talk about it with me today. Let's find out for sure. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure, Bruce. You may have heard in the intro, I was talking about life and art overlapping. Do you agree that most artists, it's impossible when you do your art to not have your life, your own life, seep into it?
Well, I can't speak for most artists. I think it's pretty impossible that not to occur for me. There's the old story that Stephen Crane could write, the greatest novel about the Civil War by walking through an old barracks. So,
yeah.
maybe those more talented than I am can reach a little farther. But for me, it gets in there even when I'm not trying. It's just has to do with how I view the world.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And I think the one thing you can't get away from, no matter what you write about as an artist, is what you're interested in. You know, I personally cannot do anything better than when I'm really interested in that thing. And so that, what you're interested in is so much about part of who you are. At least it is for me. Do you find that to be the case for yourself?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that... the stuff that you're interested in, or sometimes it's the stuff that seems to sort of continually shaping you that you bang up against and that you continue to wrestle with it seems to me that we're constantly studying it's a matter of it's a little bit like when my son's was a really good trombone player and we didn't have to tell him to practice, we had to tell him to stop.
right.
And so as a writer, I think sometimes I have to tell myself, okay, enough of, you know, enough of that. I've got to temper it a little bit. But, yeah, I think that, you know, there are a number of forces that shaped me, and sometimes those forces are positive and sometimes they're negative. But I think that they continue shaping me, whether I, you know, whether I acknowledge it or not.
And as I recall, because Bruce and I had to our listeners now, I'm speaking, Bruce and I had another conversation earlier when you released Lonesome Animals, your first novel, and that was a video interview on Author a year or so back. And I think then we talked about violence and how much just, not necessarily how much violence you necessarily were exposed to, but just your awareness of it as a young man growing up in kind of a hard scrabble area. And I know there was a lot of violence in your family tree. Was it your great grandfather and your maternal grandfather, if I got it right?
My great grandfather and his son-in-law. Yeah.
There was
My great grandfather murdered my grandfather, who was his son-in-law, out at the ranch where my family comes from, and I think both that act and the violence in it and also the silence that grew up around it, I think together those things really had a powerful shape, powerful force in shaping me. And then the fact that I grew up in a culture that kind of encourages silence and encourages violence, or at least acts on violence. I think, you know, that probably inflated those elements in my perspective. And then I was, when I was 22, I was involved in a shooting accident with a friend, and he died, and I was the one who pulled the trigger. And examining the gun he gave me to look at, and I wrote about it for the New York Times last year. And,
yeah.
So that all that stuff is, you know, continues to circle me and haunt me.
Sure.
I think I make an effort to try to sort of see what's underneath it. You know, where it comes from. And when I talk about the mythology of the West, that's a lot of what I'm talking about, is where it comes from and how it shapes and misshapes people now.
Yeah. And the mythology of the West is so linked to violence, is so linked to guns, is so linked to, the stories vary, but there is almost a raising up of that act of violence in self-protection, is the highest kind of good almost.
It's justice. Yeah. It's not just self-protection. Yeah. That's the judge. You know, if somebody crosses you, you know, you're perceived as kind of weak if you go to the police or if you go to somebody else to solve the problem.
Right.
You solve it yourself. And people with guns tend to solve problems with guns, or at least they did.
Yeah.
And so you get, you know, you get really, well, you end up with this inflated idea of violence and justice being, you know, hand in hand.
And, you know, I was just thinking about something you said reminds me of I write a daily column for the magazine, and I post it, and I just posted today's was about storytelling and problems. And you just said about how, you know, if you have a problem, you solve it yourself, and if you have a gun, you solve it with a gun. But it seems to me that the storyteller has to create a problem and then find some solution to it on his or her own. I mean, the story always has a problem, right? There has to be some problem for the story to exist.
Right.
And within the problem usually is some form of the solution in a way, whatever that solution may be. I mean, usually you want to grow organically out of the problem itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so you're dealing with problems. Yeah, out of the character, but the character usually, and usually the problem is the character sees things inaccurately. That's been my, you know, that's sort of been my spin on most stories. So, but that's what you do anyway as a storyteller, is you try to find solutions to these problems that you create, that you perceive.
Yeah.
Your own, what you consider to be the true solution, what would satisfy you in some way, maybe.
Well, no, I guess.
Satisfies the abstract word. Go ahead.
I guess what I'd say is that what I'm interested in to a certain extent, is sort of peeling back the sort of aura around the myth and the aura around the actions that built that myth, peeling that back and looking at it without all the romance. And if there's a problem, the problem is that, you know, it's that the myth has been romanticized to the point where people act on it in ways that just don't make sense, and in ways counterproductive to their own lives.
Right.
And so I would say I'm less, maybe in this recent book, I'm trying to solve that problem, or at least explore the idea that it can be solved. But what I find myself most interested in is sort of getting underneath that idea, entertaining that idea, and then getting underneath it and seeing what it really does to people. This is the story, but what does the story really do to people? How does it warp their lives?
You know, it's so true. Getting underneath things. So I've been writing mostly memoir for the last few years, and I teach it. And the thing I always say, and the thing I have to practice and remember always, is that the story exists far beneath the events. That the events are what they are, but to really understand what happened, even to your own self, you have to get as far beneath it as possible to where the reality exists, at least what I perceive of as the reality. But it's funny, you're kind of working with two layers of story, sounds like, Bruce. You've got the myth, which, of course, is just a story, right? It's a version of a story, and you're trying to retell the story in a way that helps show. Because, I mean, to some degree what you're saying is the myth really doesn't, not only doesn't do us no good, but when people act from the myth, they run hard up against the wall of reality and suffer from that. Would you say that's accurate?
Well, I would say that the weird thing is that the West that's mythologized only lasted about 20 years.
Yeah, I know.
That, you know, people forget that Sitting Bull, not long after the Battle of Little Bighorn, Sitting Bull was in Paris acting the Little Bighorn out with the Buffalo Bill show.
He was?
Yeah.
I did not know that. Well, interesting.
And that, you know, that Wyatt Earp was an advisor on Hollywood sets and a sports writer, and you know, that period was really short, and I think because it was so hyped by pulp novelists and by politicians who, you know, wanted to thrust West, that it outgrew its real place in history. And it also didn't go through the period of oral storytelling that most myths do. You know, I mean, when Homer wrote down the Iliad, that story had been retold for hundreds of years before he got hold of it. And so there wasn't the kind of strain of years of truth and sort of sorting out that occurs. So it's a sort of strange warped story that kind of came to us without a filter. And the trouble is that period passed, the period passed a lot quickly than the story did, and people try to apply that story to situations that just doesn't function. You know, I mean,
no.
If you follow the Western myth very closely, you're going to end up in jail or dead.
Right. Yes. Yes, you will. And the whole myth, it seems to me, part of it has to do with the question of what would you do if you were stripped of society, essentially? You know, because you basically have like a civilized person in a place where society, as we know it, is down to its bones. So what are you worth on your own? Because, you know, most of us never have that question put to us in a way. Because society is always there.
Yeah, and the irony is most of these guys that left society left because they were somehow broken or weren't functioning very well anyway.
Right, right.
And the American myth is, or the Western myth is really about self-annihilation. You know, people come out west because nothing's here, and then all of a sudden they're here, and they're the beginning of, you know, people follow them. It happened with the mountain men and the pioneers and everything else, that they sow the seeds. The people who first fought the Indians sowed the seeds of their own destruction by eliminating the Indians. Now they're the ones that people had to get rid of.
Right.
And,
so let me ask you this. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you. This is a slight change of topic, but I'm always interested in how the different parts of people's lives overlap. You have a day job. You're a teacher, and you teach what you describe. I love this description as school resistant students.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking to someone who's got one of those myself. I'm actually homeschooling him. He was so school resistant, we finally just had to pull him out altogether. And so you do that. That's your day job. And no one can. Is that still your? Are you still doing that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And you can't do that unless you like doing it, it seems to me. And if you don't like doing it, you better get out of it. So I assume that still brings you some pleasure.
There are far too many people doing it who don't like doing it.
That's the
problem. I enjoy it, and I enjoy the kids who don't like school. And so because that's kind of a unique sort of – I always taught the advanced placement kids, the kids who were going on to Ivy League schools, but I always had a class of regular English.
Yeah.
And it didn't take my bosses long enough to figure out that all the kids who couldn't get along with anybody else could get along with me. And so we ended up finally constructing a class just for those kids who couldn't get along, because we were getting more and more of them. And so we constructed my whole job now is dealing with those kids. And yeah, you have to like it. And the kids, boy, I tell you, the kids know if you don't like it.
Yes.
They know right away if you don't want to be there.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, my son who's we're now schooling at home, he was furious at the teacher's lack of interest in their job. Interesting. For
exactly.
a guy who like couldn't stand this, he was like, "This is important. They should be thinking creatively about this, and this is just matters." And he would, as much as he wanted out of there, he was just as upset what he perceived, although I got to say they were trying pretty hard with him, but he perceived not enough imagination on their part was his complaint.
Well, and that part of that's the system that's weighing down education, the idea of the standardized testing and everybody, you know, doing the same stuff at the same time makes it pretty difficult for teachers to get excited about anything but measuring kids.
Right.
And it's, well...
We could go on about that, but...
Yeah, it's a mess.
Which I'm always interested in education, because I do feel that, even though this is a show for writers, I do think how we learn, because so now I'm teaching my son, and of course I'm writing, and what I see is that when I go and teach people writing, and I'm teaching adults who pay money to ask me to teach them to write, you know, I'm not having to do it with students in a public school system, but I would say you've got to find what you're interested in. You find what you're interested in, you bring your interest to it, and that's going to be your lead. You've got to have the craft and all that, but without your curiosity, without your passion, it's going to happen. And what I see when I try and teach my son, that unless he's interested, nothing's happening. I can teach my brains out, but unless he steps forward, it ain't happening, right?
And as a teacher, especially with these kids, because that's the biggest problem. It's not that they're not very smart. They're not intelligent. They are. The biggest problem is to get them engaged. You know, for the idea is to get them in a place where A, they feel safe, and B, they feel like what's happening in school is worth their time, that they spending time thinking about this thing or that thing is, you know, it's not just that it benefits them because they get the grades that they're supposed to get, because these kids don't care about grades.
That's
it's
right.
About whether it feeds them.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's a profound question. What's in it for me besides this grade? Because I saw with my son, he didn't care about grades, and I thought, oh, man, how do you do school if you don't care about grades? Because not that that's not the only impetus, but it's a big part of it. It's a big part of it. It's a big part of the motivational process for a lot of the kids.
The big problem, one of the big problems is, especially high schools function, the thing high schools value the most is obedience. You know, turning in papers on time, doing what you're supposed to do, raising your hand, you know, all that stuff. Right. And the problem is that obedience is a pretty lousy intellectual trait.
I know. Yeah.
And so,
well, it's just the opposite, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't get kids questioning you and saying, you know, I don't think that's fair, or I don't think that was why he did it. And so you have to create an environment, or at least I found for me, I have to create an environment where kids can call me out and say, hey, that wasn't right, you know?
Yeah.
And I found in my own life with my own kids, I've had to do that too, that they've, you know, there have been times where they've said, Dad, you're wrong on this one, and I have to, you know, swallow my pride and say, yeah, you know, let's fix it.
I hear that all the time. So maybe I'm doing something right, because I hear that all the time.
Well, if you're worried about what your kids are interested in, then you're doing something right. I mean, my three kids are all doing what they're interested in, and I'm really happy about that.
No, there's nothing better than that. We actually have a caller here, Bruce, who'd like to ask you a question,
okay.
I believe. Jeff, is that you?
It is me, Bill. Another excellent and fascinating interview. I'm such a fan of Bruce's work, and the Old West, of course, as I think most men are. Bruce, I noticed that you are also a published poet as well. My question to you is, do you approach writing your poetry from a different perspective, I mean a different place, so to speak, than your prose, or is it a similar process for you?
Oh, good question, Jeff. Yes, you are a poet, so what about that?
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for the kind words as well. I would say the process is different, but part of the reason the process is different is because I publish some poetry, but I don't consider myself a poet, so it's not. A lot of what I do with poetry is play.
Yeah.
And so as the nice thing about a poem is that it's so different from prose that gets you thinking about prose in a different way. But it's more of it's a little like I like to take photographs. And I'm never going to be a, you know, published photographer probably, but the exercise makes my fiction better.
Yeah.
My approach to poetry is, I would say I'm not as serious about it. My son, my youngest son, who's a very good poet, he sort of mocks my poetry.
Oh,
for good reason.
No. Oh, well. Hey, so now, but here's, see, I think poetry and prose, so I feel that my early love of poetry, which I did, it really was what woke me up to what you could do with language, not just do with language, but where you could go emotionally and philosophically and spiritually with it, was really poetry. But, and even though I didn't end up being a poet, I felt it had the most influence on my writing, was understanding language in that. Because isn't poetry, you have to be economical in poetry in a way sometimes. You don't have to be with prose. At least I felt that it taught me economy in a way, and creativity, because you need creativity to be economical.
And it also, there's something about sound. that I sound is really important to me. When I'm writing, a lot of times when I make editing decisions, they're based entirely on a sound or a rhythm, and I'm listening to voices or writing dialogue. It's the rhythms that I knew and grew up with. So, and poetry is so, I mean, the best poetry relies so much on sound that that's at least half the experience. So it makes you aware of language functioning on a purely musical level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is musical. I mean, when you think about it, language has rhythm. It has highs and lows. There's gutters. There's Fs.
Yeah.
I mean, every sound's a sound's a sound, and they all have a different emotional impact on us. Absolutely.
Yeah. When I teach it to my high school kids, we start off without number one, they all want to know what the hidden meaning is, and I say, if you say hidden meaning in my class, you're kicked out.
Good. Oh, good for you.
We talk about words making sounds, and then we talk about the different poetic feet and how the words create the feet and or the sound, and we talk about music a lot and the idea that if you were to sit down and just read the lyrics of your favorite song and take the music out, you'd only get half the experience. Well, poetry
is
the same way. If you read it without the music, then you're only really enjoying half the experience. And when we try to just tie it to meaning, well, then we're really limiting the experience to, we're trying to find the sum of a math problem.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's a felt experience. And by the way, every artist knows that the reader has their own sovereign experience of the work, and that's how it's meant to be. You don't want to walk around and tell everybody reading your novel, this is what it means, and you have to understand this, or you got it wrong. You leave open space for their imagination. That's the whole point.
I don't think that most writers are interested in meaning. I mean, if they were, then they would write philosophy. I think most of us are interested in experience, and so you write a poem or you write a story or a novel or anything else to create this experience that people go through, and hopefully it's a genuine experience that it engages them. But the last thing I want to talk to, when I'm talking to somebody about my novel, the last thing that I want to talk to about is what it means, because, hell, I don't know.
That's right. But what you do know is that you wanted to create a meaningful experience. Yes? I mean, a meaning and a feeling, a felt experience is usually the destination of most art. I want to take you to this felt place, and then you can figure out whatever the hell that means for your own self. Oh,
yeah,
so silly.
I mean, that's the great thing is when you really encounter a piece of art, the only thing you can do to explain it to somebody else is hand them the book or say, come and
see
this
painting. That's right. Oh, my God. Our time is up. Bruce, this was a fast, furious, and fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, I enjoyed it, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Okay, it's The Hour of Lead. Yes, available where all fine books are sold. I believe. Is that true, Bruce? They can get it anywhere?
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. I've found it most places. I was over in Seattle doing some readings and wandered into some bookstores, and it was there. So,
awesome. Okay. The Hour of Lead. The Hour of Lead. Everybody go buy it. It's awesome. Bruce, good luck with the next book.
Thanks. Hopefully it'll be coming out soon.
Oh, it will be. It'll be good. Oh, that was good. Yes. Meaning? And get curious. Get curious about what means something to you. Okay, I only got a few seconds left. Starting next week, I will be joining Authors on Air Global Network. It's a conglomeration of authors blogging on Blog Talk Radio. Don't worry, it'll be the same old show. I'll post it on Twitter and Facebook and Author Magazine, wherever you want to find it. But starting next week, Author to Author will be on the Authors on Air Global Network. And I'll be starting off with the fabulous Laura Munson, one of my very favorite people. So don't miss it. But until then... Well, you know what I... Do what you love, love what you love, and you can't go wrong. No, you can't.